Bitcoin network grows, those assets become more useful. I can use them more effectively, more efficiently, and the stronger it grows, the stronger the network effect grows, and it starts sucking more and more users in into this self-fulfilling black hole that consumes all value.
Hello, and welcome to Bitcoin and the Bible, a show for Christians who love God's word, care about sound money, and want to learn about the moral case for Bitcoin. Join us as we hold fast to God's word and hodl Bitcoin. Hello, everyone. My name is Simon, and I'm here with my Bitcoin brothers, Will and David.
Hey, Simon.
Hey, Simon.
Guys, water has gone underneath the bridge since our episode last week, but we have a lot to cover today. But before we do, I just wanted to give us a little bit of a connection to last week's episode. We're talking about Bitcoin as money and then separating it from Bitcoin as technology. And today we're going to talk about Bitcoin as a network. And all of this is going to fit together into a nice package in that we'll be building the foundation of what Bitcoin is so that we can then go back to God's word as we started our podcast with and start going piece by piece through God's revealed will through his scriptures and seeing, does Bitcoin match his character, his providence, and can Christians use it today and how can they use it today? And that's why today's episode is so important, because it stems into how do we use Bitcoin? How do we take that resource that we're holding and saving in and passing down to the next generation, and can it be used? And does it have the reliability and durability to last for generations there? Now, before we dive into today's episode, we want to hold ourselves accountable to truth. And as we communicate with you, we knew that we would run into situations where we would misstate something and we would need to correct it. And so we're just going to do that today. So I want to pass it over to Will to update you on something that he's learned.
Yeah, I need to repent. So in episode 2, I stated that it is illegal to refuse to use dollars inside the United States. And that is not true. I did a little further research, and you are not required to accept dollars. So the examples that I read given were like bus tokens or Chuck E. Cheese tokens that you're allowed to use your own private currency. It's just strongly discouraged. And to David's point, you still do need to pay taxes in it, but my specific attempt at clarifying his point and adding even more of an edge to it that the government won't let you not use it is not true. So I apologize for that. I spoke out of ignorance.
And just to remind all of you, we hold ourselves to that level of standard because we know that our God is a truthful God. And what he speaks in scripture is true. It is absolute truth. We can cling to that. And we refuse to claim that we have the corner on the truth and that everything that comes out of our mouths is necessarily true. But with that, we do commit to you that we will continue to test what we say against scripture. We continue to test it against what you know and live in the world that we live in. And we'll continue to grow with you as we grow in our knowledge of God's word and how it applies to Bitcoin. Now, as we look at Bitcoin as money, our strategy has been to build this foundation and say, what is Bitcoin? And we recognize that in the first episode on Bitcoin as money, we see that Bitcoin is a ledger-based monetary system. And that has helped us then to derive how Bitcoin as a technology provides security for that ledger-based system and decentralizes it across the world into multiple copies. And therefore, we can trust that it is protected and that we're not going to be able to break it or lose it locally. Now, we want to ultimately get to the point where we can answer the question definitively. Can Christians or non-Christians trust in Bitcoin as a moral and durable and valuable monetary system? And the reason we're driving at this is we know that those of you who are thinking and evaluating and trying to decide, do I purchase Bitcoin? Do I hold Bitcoin? That you want to make sure that you're making the right decision for yourself, for your family, for your church, for your next generations. And we don't take that lightly. I've had multiple conversations over the past week with both family members and friends. And as I encourage them to look at Bitcoin as an alternative, I want to give them the resources to be able to make that decision in light of what their responsibility is to their friends, family members, and ultimately to God. Now, let's go to the Proverbs quickly here before we dive into the concept of Bitcoin as network. I just wanted to share with you one section from Proverbs chapter 11, actually two verses that help establish a foundation for how people use money. How do they employ the money that God has given them? So Proverbs 11 verse 25 says, "The generous man will be prosperous, and he who waters will himself be watered. Verse 26 says, he who withholds grain, the people will curse him, but blessing will be on the head of him who sells it. So I think this speaks to the reality that yes, we are encouraging you to hold Bitcoin and to store value for the next generation, to be able to share that with your children and their children. But we also recognize that money needs to be something that you can use. It needs to be something that you can actually transmit to someone and share with them when it comes time to be generous. Now, that time might be right now. You might want to be generous with somebody who lives in your current state, your current city, your current hometown. But it also might be that you want to share money with somebody across the world. And getting that money to them, it has been a simple thing for most people if they live in a Western country like the United States, where you can use PayPal or another network to basically transmit your money almost instantaneously with very little fees. But in other countries of the world, that's not necessarily true. And we're going to go into some examples of that today as we start to develop the case for Bitcoin as the world's first instant clearance monetary network, an improvement upon what our current system provides for us here. So to get us started, I thought I would just ask the question, what is a network? And we'll build from there. So maybe you want to take a shot at that one first, Will. What if I asked you, what is a network? What would you say?
A network is a system or group of interconnected things. So the word net at the beginning is, it shares the same root as a fishing net. So it denotes this concept of interconnectedness and strength. So the more members of this network, or the larger the network grows, the stronger and more effective that it is. So often in telecommunications, you'll see is where networks are applied, and that would be, oh, the internet is one large network or composed of a lot of small networks, but each of those networks is computers that can communicate with one another over a pre-agreed upon set of rules for communication.
Yeah, I like that. And I think the imagery of a net and the strength that a net provides, right, makes me think of how God designed spiders to build nets that have tremendous resiliency and strength to even the worst of attacks, right? They can hold up under tremendous amounts of pressure. And therefore, the concept of a digital network can also borrow from that, and it can hold energy, hold strength in it, and contain that strength in a way that shares it with every piece of the network that touches it there. So maybe then let's think about another question. What are some examples that we can think about in picture of current networks and how they became valuable or even indispensable to our world?
An obvious example to me of networks is the telephone network. So, and this exhibits one of the properties of networks, which is Metcalfe's law, that the value of a network is proportional to the square of the number of its users, which, to simplify, just think about telephones. If there was only one telephone in the entire world, it wouldn't really do much. It wouldn't be much good to anybody. You add two telephones and now two people can talk to each other. But as you start adding more telephones into the system, the power and usefulness of that network is growing exponentially. With each added user, the number of different connections that can be made is growing exponentially. So phones, roads, the more roads you have, the further you can go, the more reach and connectedness you have.
I was thinking about within a church, a small group ministry within a church can add tremendous strength to the church through the connectedness of the members. If you're part of a large congregation that has no way to break itself down into smaller components and be connected to each other, then there's not a lot of strength in that. You know, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. They're kind of all dependent on one person. But if you have a robust and vibrant small group kind of ministry with shepherds and so forth, then the church is far stronger. And so that seems like that's a human network that adds strength and resiliency to a local congregation.
Yeah, I think of information as well and how quickly information travels. I remember sitting at a recent conference where we were learning about Charles Spurgeon and just being shocked that the information that Charles Spurgeon preached on a Sunday could be transmitted across the Atlantic Ocean and could arrive in the United States and be shared in the newspaper the next morning with those who wanted to hear about that. That's really powerful because we think about how networks share and transmit information across both space and time, and storing that information and using it is one of the keys that a network unlocks. And I like to also kind of think back to the analogy of how networks don't function well, right? So I hate to be picking on gold, but the reality is if I want to sell gold, it's very difficult to find an immediate buyer. I literally have to often either drive somewhere or mail my gold somewhere physically to find a buyer that will be willing to pay for the gold that I want to sell. It starts to point to the reality that when a society doesn't have a network, things get more clunky, they get more expensive, they get more difficult, they get more painful for us to navigate when we're not using or taking advantage of the resources of a network. So now that we've gone through the definition of a network, again, we're trying to tie together the reality that Bitcoin is a monetary network. It's becoming more and more so each day. And one of the primary advocates for and proponents for Bitcoin as a monetary network currently in our world is Michael Saylor. Now, some of you know that name, and some of you might need to be introduced to him. Michael Saylor is the CEO of a company called MicroStrategy, and it's a software company, and he is a well-educated man, went to MIT, and has a great foundation of knowledge, both from having run his own business and served as a CEO of a publicly traded company, but obviously having seen and written about the growth of networks of technology companies over the past 10 to 15 years. He speaks from a level of experience, and he has done an excellent job of basically describing how Bitcoin is the next network that will dematerialize the information that other networks or lack thereof have basically been built on. So maybe, Will, if you could give us a couple of examples there of ways in which networks have grown over the past 10 to 15 years.
We can look at examples like Netflix and Blockbuster. Blockbusters were everywhere. They had this large analog network of retail distribution of rented movies. And then the digital version came along, which was Netflix. And in the early days, Netflix would just mail you DVDs, and Blockbuster didn't really see the value in it. They didn't see a threat because the internet wasn't ready to stream movies. And then it was all of a sudden, and Netflix started streaming movies over the internet. And now you have a digital network that can transmit that information at a scale and a speed that no analog system could ever hope to compete with. What was Blockbuster's biggest asset, which was having a retail store on every corner, now became its biggest liability. In this new dematerialized world, all of those retail spaces were costing them insane amounts of money, and they couldn't compete. They didn't know what to do. So
they added candy aisles.
And went bankrupt. And you see that again with Amazon and big box retail stores. So Amazon came in and they dematerialized the storefront. They digitized it. And now everyone can access a storefront, and you can search it and you can find exactly what you need. And they are connecting buyers and sellers globally at a speed that was unimaginable in a retail store. To have a retail store, you have someone whose job is to look at the store and figure out what kind of product should we put on this shelf. We have limited shelf space. What should we stock? Amazon flipped that model and said, what if we just stock everything and then we let the customers rank the items themselves, and now we can just surface the customer's recommendations. And now we don't have to do that at all, and we can let the distributed power of society figure out the best fit for each product. And big box stores have suffered, and a lot of retail stores have gone under.
Indeed. So let's think then about what are some of the poor alternatives that Bitcoin will subsume or replace as it becomes a full-fledged monetary network.
Western Union.
Yes, that is probably right now one of the most glaring examples. So Western Union is a service that you probably see in your Albertsons and wonder who's actually using that. And that's because we are privileged, most of us, that all the three of us here in this room and a lot of our listeners are privileged to live in affluent Western societies that don't send remittances back home to family in impoverished nations. But Western Union is heavily used by folks needing to send money back home to their family. So they leave a poor country, they come to America, they work hard, they earn money, they try to send it back to their family. And the good folks at Western Union only take somewhere in the ballpark of 20% cut on the way through. And the reason that they do that is because they are the only ones who have gone through the hassle of setting up a monetary network that meets all of the regulations to fit into the existing banking system. So to transmit money between nations, there's a ton of paperwork. And Western Union has gone and done all of that paperwork, and they sit there and they lord over their exorbitant privilege of being the only ones with access. And they charge exorbitant rates to do that.
Indeed.
Yeah, even here in the West, I mean, we're certainly not suffering anywhere near like those in third world countries and that you just articulated, but even to move money around here, you know, try to send a wire transfer. And I mean, it's an incredible hassle and it takes days for the money to get there.
I still drive my rent check to drop it off at the local bank because my options are either $3 charge for a ACH transaction that will clear in 3 to 5 business days or $30 for an overnight one. So every month I end up just driving a paper check over and dropping it off because the legacy networks just don't cut it.
Yeah. And you even see that when you're doing business, right? If you want to take online payments and you're a small business, you're going to go through PayPal or Stripe or Square, and you're going to pay 3.9% plus a service fee such that you're basically almost trying to talk your customers into paying you in cash just so you can save on the fees that you would have to pay if you're trying to make it easy on yourself and others by taking a digital form of payment.
Right. It's easy for the customer to swipe their card. It's the merchant who bears the brunt of the costs of moving money through the legacy system.
I would venture most customers have never stopped to wonder where the rewards points for their credit cards are coming from, and they don't realize that it's the merchants that are paying for them.
Indeed. So it begs the question, right? We don't expect that you're never going to pay for fees for anything in a future where you're using the Bitcoin monetary network. But one of the things we are driving towards is the reality that you don't have to. The world is not built on the reality that you have to have these fees in place. And that's where I love where we are going. We're recording this episode tonight on September the 6th, which is the day before El Salvador adopts Bitcoin as legal tender. And for those of you who know the historical background and development of this over the past couple of months, forgive us that we've talked to a lot of people who have not heard this before. So we'd like to just give a brief recap of the reality that El Salvador is a nation that has been kind of destroyed. It has lost its own currency and has forced to adopt the U.S. dollar as its currency, thereby tying itself to the U.S. monetary policy. And as the dollar goes, so El Salvador goes. Further, El Salvador has lost a lot of its internal GDP and has been forced to absorb a lot of the money that comes back into El Salvador from people working outside of El Salvador and receive that money back through remittances. So that has created a situation where a lot of money and a lot of danger is created for the people in El Salvador, or a lot of money is lost for the people in El Salvador by virtue of the legacy system, the Western Union of the world, where a person working and living in Miami, for example, wants to send money to their friends or family back home in El Salvador. They're forced to pay the fees that it takes to wire that money to their family member in El Salvador, forcing their family member to walk, bike, ride, however long that distance is, to the local Western Union office, where it's often a very dangerous place to walk into and back out of with money in your pocket, just to get a portion of that money that was originally earned. And a significant portion of El Salvador's GDP comes into El Salvador in the form of remittances and comes to people who are predominantly unbanked. The figure that I've heard is 70% of El Salvador is estimated to be unbanked. So we're rejoicing in the reality that in God's good providence, through a president that we have no idea how whether he is a good individual or not, but we rejoice in the good decision that he has made to basically allow Bitcoin to be legal tender in El Salvador alongside of the U.S. dollar. And this has obviously been made possible through the work of several different groups that have gone into El Salvador and started to develop the Bitcoin monetary network to allow individuals to receive their money from their friend or family member in another country through the Bitcoin network without paying those exorbitant fees, and then to turn around and have alternatives to how to use that money, whether it's converting it back into the local currency or dollars there to be able to be using it there, or in a better world, be able to use it as Bitcoin and share it with a merchant who accepts money in Bitcoin as well. So, Will, I know that this is something that excites you just as much as it excites me. Both of us, when we hear the CEO of a company called Strike a man named Jack Mahler's talk about this project and where this is going, we get excited because we see the potential for what Bitcoin as a monetary network can do, not just for countries like El Salvador, but for countries all around the world. So maybe share a little bit of that passion that we've inherited by listening to Jack Mahler's talk.
I would love to. I think before we can really understand the significance of what you were just talking about, it's important to maybe draw some lines that maybe other people wouldn't have thought of or don't really understand. So if I PayPal you some money, I'm not really sending dollars. Dollars haven't moved in the system at large. I'm moving IOUs inside the PayPal account, and it doesn't settle instantly. In fact, it settles sometime nearly a month later when the final underlying dollars have finally irrevocably settled. That's why I can't PayPal a Cash App user. I can't Venmo a PayPal user. These are closed monetary networks. So we often think, oh, I can move money instantly and free. Well, no, you're not really. You can move things inside Cash App for free. You can move stuff inside Venmo for free. You can move stuff inside PayPal for free. But those are closed monetary networks that don't talk to each other. If I want to PayPal a Cash App user, I can't do it. I have to open a Cash App account, or he has to open a PayPal account. So what happened in El Salvador is that there's a local project down in El Zonte, El Salvador, called Bitcoin Beach. And in Bitcoin Beach, there are some folks who have been working with the local merchants there, helping them to accept Bitcoin predominantly via the Lightning Network. And we won't dive into all of the technical details here, but suffice it to say, the Lightning Network is a layer two abstraction built on top of Bitcoin that enables you to instantaneously transmit value with final settlement assurances for nearly no cost. And that is an important distinction. You'll have a lot of people say, oh, Bitcoin could never be money. It's too slow. Oh, Bitcoin could never be money. The transaction fees are too high. The mining fees are too high. And that's true. Bitcoin, the base layer on chain, could never serve the capacity of the entire world doing transactions. But like everything else in life, layers is where we get efficiency. So what Strike done? Strike went down and they started helping these vendors, setting up Lightning wallets, teaching them, educating them about Bitcoin. And you started to see this little circular economy where people were not only being able to pay each other in Bitcoin, but they were starting to prefer it. And the president, Nayib Bukele of El Salvador, saw what Jack was doing and asked him, hey, come explain this to me, talk to me. So Jack Mahler went, talked to the president. What he came away with is, what we can do is we can enable the world's first open monetary network to serve in our country as a clearance system. So now, with a Lightning wallet, Mama Rosa down on Bitcoin Beach, she can suddenly accept payments instantly for free, or remittances instantly for free from anywhere in the world. And there's nothing any of the legacy banks can do to stop her. And Mama Rosa is a real person down in Bitcoin Beach. She was one of the first, if not the first vendor to accept Bitcoin. And it has been a huge blessing to her. I just saw photos on Twitter the other day of a truck she was able to buy as a result of her embracing the Bitcoin monetary network. So now we have the world's first open monetary network that's allowing the unbanked, underprivileged in El Salvador to have access to a global banking system, the first real open global banking system. So you can transmit money in and out of the country without paying these exorbitant fees. You can transfer it instantly, have final settlement. There's no time for revocation. There's no chargebacks. There's no fraud disputes. All of that is gone because the Bitcoin network takes care of it. So it's the best way of transmitting value. And the genius of the Strike app is that Strike users don't have to actually care about Bitcoin, the money. So we've talked in previous episodes about Bitcoin as money, and Bitcoin itself is the bearer token of the Bitcoin monetary network. But the Bitcoin monetary network is bigger than just Bitcoin, the store of value. Bitcoin, the store of value is really great, and it's interesting, and it's cool, and humanity needs it desperately. But I would argue the world almost needs Bitcoin, the network, more. So Bitcoin, the network, is the way of transmitting value. So what Strike allows people to do is they see dollars in their Strike account. And if I Strike you some money, they take my dollars, they would buy Bitcoin with it. They would transmit Bitcoin over the Lightning Network instantly and at zero cost or nearly zero cost to the Strike user on the other end. And they would then take that Bitcoin and convert back into their local currency where they could see pounds or euros or whatever it is that they're using appear in their Strike account instantly. And so now, even if neither party likes Bitcoin, wants to hold Bitcoin, they don't have to. They don't have to care about that. They can transmit from one currency to another currency 24/7, 365 in a way that has never been possible ever before.
This is the full disintermediation of the legacy banking system. The gatekeepers are going to fall away, which explains, this is a rabbit trail, but this explains all of the opposition against Bitcoin that you read about, particularly here in the U.S., because we have the exorbitant privilege of the U.S. dollar. And thus, the banks own the politicians, and thus the politicians as well. They can read the handwriting on the wall, too. I mean, their gravy train is ending, and they're not happy.
Indeed. And I like that you slowed us down a little bit there, Will, to think about the mechanisms of how you send money over the Lightning Network between two individuals and how it loses that counterparty. You're not going through PayPal and the banking system, the banks that are allowed to make transfers between organizations that also have the capacity to lock you out from making that transfer if you're trying to send money to someone who they don't want you to, or if you're not allowed to send money to anyone. And we're not in this world here trying to recommend to you that you try to basically do things out of the system at all possible costs. But we are facing a world where you may not have the freedom that you want to be able to send money to your friends, family, church, or missionaries without having to go outside of the system. And the reality that Bitcoin provides you that freedom to go person to person, direct, without the counterparty risk in the middle, without the inability to have that locked out, is the key that we're driving towards here. Obviously, I love the reality that it's so cheap as well. I love the fact that the Lightning Network is taking the cost of sending money out of the system and allowing me to save more of my money and use it for what God has intended it to be used for. But I like the freedom almost as much, if not more. And I think that's one of the most powerful aspects of Bitcoin is that it's freedom money. It gives the individual the freedom to use the money that they have earned to be generous with and love the individuals in their life without having to go through the government or the banking system's approval structures.
This is huge for Christians. We have examples of the legacy system locking people out, either locking down their accounts or denying them access to the payment rails. So you were talking with somebody on Twitter, right? A church situation where they had their money frozen in PayPal. Maybe you want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it strikes home for me because I know that many churches around the world take advantage of the structure that PayPal provides to give and to receive online. And it's not the only structure that exists out there, but this particular church had their account frozen by PayPal and had their assets frozen. The assets that they had already received, which were in PayPal's system, were inaccessible to them for a period of time, up to 6 months before they could be released. I think that the reality that we trust that our current system is going to do us right, and if it doesn't, that we'll be able to remedy that through our current legal system, is an inherently Western mindset. I have confidence that in the United States at this point in time, if somebody does me wrong, I'm eventually going to be able to get my money back.
It may cost you a fortune to get it.
Right. But I'm already looking at situations around me where I realize that people are going to lose their jobs. People are going to lose their opportunity to make money. And if I have been given the opportunity by God to be generous with those individuals, then obviously if I live close to them, I can drive over and give them some fiat. But if not, then I have to make a decision. Am I going to send that money through the traditional banking system, or am I going to find an alternative? And Bitcoin provides me that alternative in a way that nothing ever has before.
What about those here, even in the U.S., that don't have access to the banking system? I don't know what the percentage is, but it's not immaterial. we have basically gotten to a place where those that hold assets puts them close to the money printer and the banking system works for them. But those who don't hold assets often don't even hold bank accounts. And so they're forced upon alternatives, whether it's payday loans or pawn shops or whatever mechanism they have to either move money around or to try to store value or whatever. And the interest rates in that realm are exorbitant.
I was just a few months ago reading an example of some kids who figured out that they didn't have bank accounts. They were unbanked. But they figured out that they could use GameStop as their financial system. So they would go in and they would pre-order games and use the down payment as their method of depositing. And they could then later go to another GameStop in another area of town and cancel that pre-order and get the money back. At the time, it seemed, oh, that's kind of clever and funny. But to stop and think, no, that's the symptom of a monetary network and a monetary system that's not really open to everyone. And I think that for those of us who've been privileged enough to have bank accounts our whole life, we don't really understand what that's like.
Indeed. So this begs the question. There's so much promise here, but we recognize that we're not fully there yet. And to be fair, Strike is not available across the world yet. Will obviously recognize that or mention that it's going to be available in El Salvador initially, which is one of the first international countries outside of the United States. But even in a place like Canada, it's not available yet. So we're not there yet. And I think we just need to ask that question. What needs to change or improve in Bitcoin as a technology and monetary network before its capacity to serve as the world's monetary network is fully realized?
So the great thing is that because Bitcoin is an open monetary network, in some senses, it doesn't matter if Strike is available in your country yet. So let's say I live in Taiwan and Strike is not available there. Well, it's not really a problem. It's just a minor inconvenience. I can still go to my local Bitcoin exchange, buy Bitcoin with whatever my local currency is, send that Bitcoin over the Bitcoin Lightning Network or through on-chain transactions to a Strike user in America. I'm still interoperable with them because it's an open network. And if Strike has a competitor in Taiwan that operates on top of the Bitcoin Lightning Network, Strike and that competitor will be interoperable with one another. Because Strike is not building its own closed ecosystem walled garden. They're simply operating on top of an existing open network.
That's a huge point. So earlier you referred to, if you've got PayPal, you got to be in the PayPal network, or you got to be in the Venmo network, and they don't talk to each other. And so the barriers to entry, the friction is high in these. But what you're talking about now is there could be many innovations, many different interfaces, but they'll all travel across this open monetary rail.
So imagine for a second a world where every bank account is able to natively talk to every other bank account without clearance fees and clearance time, or where PayPal and Venmo and Cash App are all completely interoperable, use the app that you like, and you can send to anyone else anywhere in the world, 365, no fees. It just works all the time. That's what's being built right now. And it exists. There are room for improvement. So Strike is the first. It won't be the last company that sees this and starts innovating. Strike is, I believe, destined to be one of the largest companies in the US. There is so much market here for them to eat. Venmo and Cash App, PayPal, they're dead. They may not realize it yet, but they're dead because their value comes from their proprietary walled garden. Their value only grows if their walled garden grows. Strike's value grows every time a new competitor joins the network, right? So if there's a new compelling app in Malaysia, that just added more potential users for the Strike network because Strike is built on top of Bitcoin, doesn't have its own network, it doesn't need one. So it's additive.
Genius.
Will, I know we use a term that I think we should define and introduce to the audience that has not heard of it. We use the terminology network effect. Is what you just referred to there an example of a network effect? And if not, what else is it?
It is a network effect. So a network grows and becomes more useful the larger it gets and the more interoperable it becomes. So the network effect is that as the network grows, it becomes self-feeding. Right? Why are there 7 billion Facebook accounts? Because for most of the world, it's just an expectation that you're going to have one. Now, there's lately been a bit of a backlash and movement to get rid of your Facebook account, but predominantly everybody in the world has a Facebook account. So as Facebook has grown and as the number of its users has grown, the network effect has grown, right? So there's not another Facebook, right? So if I created my own Facebook.
Let's call it MySpace.
Let's call it MySpace, right? So what happened? How did Facebook beat MySpace? MySpace came along. They started to really pioneer social networking, and it was great. And Facebook came along, but MySpace was still pretty small. It was relatively niche. And Facebook worked well on mobile. MySpace didn't. MySpace allowed you to do so much customization of your site that it wouldn't load on most mobile phones at the time. Facebook was really streamlined and simple, and thus you could use it from your phone because they understood that mobile was the future. So they killed MySpace in its infancy. It really wasn't around for very long. And now as Facebook has grown, there's a reason that you don't really see any competitors anymore. And even when large corporations try to launch their own, like Google Plus, it doesn't matter. The network effect will kill it. So you would have to go and get 7 billion people to turn and create a Google Plus account. And for what? They could do the same thing. So it doesn't have to be a little bit better than Facebook. You would have to have something that's 10 times better than Facebook in order to get someone to be able to switch. And with an application, the network effect is strong, but it's not unstoppable. But with money, the network effect is even bigger, because if my money is in one network, it by necessity can't be in another network. So with a social media application, I can just have two on my phone, right? So say there's a new one that comes along, I download, install it. Well, if this thing catches on, I'm already there. But with money, I have to make a conscious choice. Where am I going to put my assets? What network are they going to reside in? And so I have them in the Bitcoin network. As the Bitcoin network grows, those assets become more useful. I can use them more effectively, more efficiently. And the stronger it grows, the stronger the network effect grows. And it starts sucking more and more users into this self-fulfilling black hole that consumes all value.
So the MySpace Facebook comparison brings up an interesting question. And David, I know you've voiced this, the concern that we've thought of and heard from others of what happens if Bitcoin is just the next network, and why can't it be replaced by something better than that?
That is, I think, one of the huge questions that I had to deal with, and that people, particularly of my generation, you know, it's a real obstacle that has to be overcome. So Bitcoin's amazing, but what about 20 years from now when something else comes along and all of a sudden, you know, Bitcoin is just pushed off the world stage? What's to stop that from happening?
At $1 trillion market cap, Bitcoin has entrenched itself as the network, and it is no longer an idea, it's a foundational protocol. It's the same reason why in the early days, there were multiple competing standards for the internet. And there was the OSI model, and there was the TCP/IP model. And there was competition over what's going to win. And once it was resolved, no one's ever looked back and tried to change it. No one's coming along saying, I'm going to make internet too. Right? I'm going to totally change the game, and I'm not going to be interoperable with this network because it's just better. That's not how that works. The internet is everywhere. And now if I come up with some radical improvement, the internet will just consume that improvement and make itself better. So we could talk about autonomous vehicles. Let's say that autonomous vehicles take over in the next few years and become really popular. They're going to still have to operate on the same legacy system of roads with speed limits and stop signs and stoplights that were built for the manned vehicles. Why? Because the network of roads exists and it's not up for debate. But autonomous vehicles would be an improvement. And so over time, those improvements would make their way into the protocol. And eventually you might see speed limits get removed as vehicles are able to judge for themselves what's the best safe speed, or stoplights no longer become necessary if the vehicles could communicate with each other at high speed and ensure that they're not going to have a traffic accident as they reach an intersection. But all of those improvements would be built on top of the existing network. No one's going to go and propose that they just build a whole new set of roads, right? You couldn't do it. You couldn't build a new internet. You can't build a new system of roads. You can't build a new Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a one and done discovery. it's not just a MySpace that's going to be surpassed by a Facebook.
Because Bitcoin solves the fundamental problem with money. We have absolute digital scarcity.
And we've taken that absolute digital scarcity and wrapped it in the first monetary network that not only is open and permissionless to all, but can transmit value at distance, which, as we've talked about before, has never been done before. So we've never had a perfectly engineered scarce money, and we've never had a monetary system that lets us transmit that perfectly scarce money at great distance. These are two separate ideas that we are so fortunate to be able to see put together in one amazing package.
Indeed. And you might be thinking to yourself today, well, Simon, I don't really need to send money to somebody in Zimbabwe. Why do I care about this? But I think that the concept of network effect is also something I want you to see, even if you only intend to hold Bitcoin as your primary store of value. The concept is that if something is making Bitcoin better across the world, it's making the Bitcoin that you own more valuable. In other words, if someone is innovatively developing a way to use Bitcoin in South Korea in the middle of the night, you wake up the next morning and your Bitcoin is more valuable because the network has absorbed that innovation, that energy, the creativity that God has given to his people to use the money that they have wisely. And that's huge for me because I love the fact that we live in a world where God has created people all across the world with this capacity. So even though I don't necessarily need to access Bitcoin as a monetary network today, the reality is that it's already preparing me for tomorrow while at the same time contributing to what Bitcoin is as a store of value. The El Salvador announcement and the news of what's going to happen in El Salvador in September is going to teach us a tremendous amount about what Bitcoin can do for the world, and other countries will be watching to be sure. And that leads into my next question for us all to look at and think about is, we talked about what might need to change or improve in Bitcoin, but what needs to change in our world before it will use Bitcoin as its primary monetary network?
You're going to have to convince old fogies like me to use it, which means that we're going to have to turn our back on the way we've been taught and brought up and what has worked for us, and I'm talking now in the Western world. In order to adopt a new network, you've got to understand the value of that network and begin to put your toe in the water, I think, and experience it. I think it's unrealistic to assume people are just going to wholesale adopt it. I mean, there'll come a time when Bitcoin will be so compelling that people will adopt it because there's no other choice. I do agree that it is going to eat the value that other assets have heretofore been seen as the store of value. I think Bitcoin is going to become that store of value for sure. But I was just thinking about Facebook. So, you know, for my generation, we weren't all that keen about Facebook, honestly. And it was just a thing for kids, for young people. And I can even recall mocking some of the posts and comparing it to my sister's diary when I was a kid growing up that she kept under lock and key, and I would try to figure out how to open and read. And I didn't have to. Now people were just posting all kinds of interesting things. But over time, what we came to see with this is that it was a way to connect, that writing a letter by hand or taking a Polaroid photo and sticking in an envelope and sending it just didn't cut it anymore. So its value proposition grew on us to the place where we pushed ourselves through the hurdle of setting up a Facebook account and beginning to use it, and then recognizing that it provided all kinds of utility.
And I think for the younger generation, it is incumbent upon us to look after our parents and the elderly in our church and to come alongside them and help them to understand, help them to operate on the Bitcoin network. If you have technical ability, get involved. There are a ton of open source projects that could use your help and time. So what needs to improve in Bitcoin is the tooling and the applications need to get better and clearer and simpler and easier to use. The first decade, Bitcoin was predominantly for tinkerers and hobbyists who really understood and cared about it and were willing to go through a ton of hurdles with really ugly user interfaces because they understood what they were doing and they really cared to be there. In this next 10 years, we need to advance that. We need to fix that. So if you have the ability to contribute, show love for your neighbor. Contribute, take some time, contribute to some open source projects. Let's build this thing. Let's make it better. Let's make it so that we can help our grandparents onboard and feel comfortable.
Yeah, so I think you've pointed to two things, and I'll just suggest one more. The first thing that you pointed to is that it's acceptance. People need to understand and accept and use Bitcoin. The second thing is we need the software applications and the interfaces to become just a little bit more user-friendly so that everyone of every age group and technological confidence can use Bitcoin. I think the third thing that we have to look at is how our government's going to treat it in terms of its capital asset versus legal tender currency status. Obviously, I don't try to spend Bitcoin actively today for two reasons. One is I want to hold it and let its value stay in my pocket, not someone else's pocket, even a merchant that I like. But the second is I really don't want to have to report and look at the tax implications of it in the United States because of how it's treated today. So I do believe that there is that hurdle. And I don't want our listeners to walk away from this podcast thinking that we're ignoring the reality that there are significant obstacles that may prevent one or more countries from using Bitcoin as a monetary medium of exchange in an everyday transactional way without going through some steps first. But I think looking at El Salvador and seeing how Bitcoin is being used across the world shows us that we already have the capacity to do so. Merchants can receive payments in Bitcoin, can pay their suppliers in Bitcoin. The circular economy can be formed. I think that the next step is for the world to begin adopting it as such and for us to facilitate that adoption through both education and development. Okay. As we've looked here, I think we've already circled in on the reality that Bitcoin is already a monetary network. It has the capacity to become an even better monetary network and to really establish a framework where Christians can hold, store, and share their money. So I think the last question I want us to think about tonight as we bring this to a close is to look at the concerns that we should have. In other words, are there concerns that we as individuals have about this open source monetary network? Are there concerns that our listeners have that we've not yet fully addressed? And how do we move forward in that light? And so I'll introduce one that I think that we've both that all three of us have talked about it at a couple different points in time. But it's the concern of looking at Bitcoin as a mini Ponzi scheme. And I'll draw it out this way. The reality that Bitcoin is an intangible asset. It's not something that you can hold in your hands. It is a medium of exchange. It's something that you can exchange for things of value to you and then use to exchange with others for things of value. And by doing so, you are creating a value of that intangible asset in and of itself. But I know this fear existed in my mind, and I know it exists in others when they first come to Bitcoin, that they are going to exchange their value, their life, their energy, their time, their resources to someone else who is going to give them this digital asset, this token, and that suddenly they're going to find themselves with a whole pile of these tokens that nobody wants and kind of the one everybody's laughing at because they just didn't figure out the game at the beginning and suddenly they're the ones left holding the bag while everyone else walks away with all of the valuable stuff. So let's think about that. Is that a concern? Is that a reality?
I think this concern stems from two misunderstandings. The first misunderstanding is the theory of intrinsic value. So people think that everything has an intrinsic value, and they look at Bitcoin and they say, well, it doesn't seem to have any intrinsic value, and so it must just be this game of hot potato, where as long as I don't hold on to it for too long, then I'm not going to be the one that gets burned. The theory of intrinsic value is a much deeper endeavor to study, which I would recommend go look into it. And you, I think you will come away rapidly convinced that there is no such thing as intrinsic value. A off-the-cuff example is if you were on a deserted island and you were starving and someone had a bar of gold and a cheeseburger, you would rather have the cheeseburger than the bar of gold. It doesn't matter that the bar of gold is quote-unquote more valuable. To you, it's not. The burger is more valuable, right? So the free market will decide value based on utility and on network effect. So gold is not at however many dollars it is currently, 1800, I assume it hasn't moved much, because there is intrinsically $1,800 of value in gold. Gold is $1,800 because that's the demand for gold in the free market. So if we understand that Bitcoin has no intrinsic value because nothing has intrinsic value, but the value is derived from the needs of the free market, then we can feel a little more comfortable holding an intangible good. All we've done is we've separated out the monetary concerns of gold with the utility concerns of gold. So now we just have a pure monetary asset.
We hold intangible assets in your bank account. It's nothing but digits on the screen of a computer, which they're happy to replace with other digits, but you can't touch it. I mean, unless you're the kind of guy who's going to hold it all in paper, then you have an intangible asset.
Exactly.
That is being inflated away at 20% a year.
And the second misunderstanding is really just a restatement of something that I just talked about in the first, which is that the network effect of money drives its value. So if I walk into the local 7-Eleven with some glass beads to try to pay, no one else cares that I have glass beads. That's not a valuable currency. They're not on my monetary network. So the value is not very high. As more people onboard onto the Bitcoin network and they desire to hold Bitcoin, it's perfectly scarce. So the Bitcoin that's available for sale that people are willing to part with has to be divvied up and is divided by the number of dollars or euros or whatever that people are looking to exchange for it. That drives the price up. So Bitcoin, you're seeing two things. You're seeing one, you're seeing a monetary network that is growing because of the network effect of a digital network dematerializing an analog, which we look back at the Netflix Blockbuster example. We know that has massive exponential effects. So it's growing rapidly, which explains a lot of the giant pumps in price. And the second reason that the price is going up is because your unit of account is wrong. Don't look at your Bitcoin and think it's volatile. It's not. Yes, it's appreciating in value because the network is growing, but I would argue predominantly it's really appreciating in value because the fiat that you're measuring it against is falling. So you would not look at the dollars in your bank account and compare them against bolivars every day and say, oh man, look how much richer I am because the bolivar has crashed. Right? You wouldn't do that. Your unit of account is dollars. You're thinking in dollars. You're looking at dollars. You would just say, oh no, I have the same $32 yesterday and that I do today, right? Nothing has changed. Look at your Bitcoin the same way. Once you have the Bitcoin, one Bitcoin is always one Bitcoin. It doesn't matter what the dollar is doing. The Fed is doing their best to print it to oblivion. It's not volatile. It's the only stable monetary system in the world.
And if you were like me last year and you went through the analysis and said, is Bitcoin money? Is it fungible? Is it divisible? Is it scarce? And so forth. And you got to all of those definitions and satisfied it with yes. The last thing you were asking yourself is, do people want it? Is there demand for this? Because if there is no demand for this, it doesn't matter how good it looks on paper. People have to want it. And I think that's where you can be the most encouraged of where we are right now in the middle of 2021 is to say it's existed for 12 years and people across the world, governments, businesses, individuals are storing their money in Bitcoin. There's a demand for this. Now, don't get into it just for the demand, right? But recognize that if you're worried about whether people around the world actually want to do business and use Bitcoin, you can be confident that they are. And there's clear evidence of that to this point now.
Don't buy Bitcoin thinking that it's just going to go up in US dollars and you're going to trade back out of it again. If you do that, first off, you're likely to get burned. You're likely to get discouraged by the volatility and sell at the wrong place. But beyond that, you really don't understand what's going on. And so it's pure speculation for you to do that. You might as well go to Las Vegas and put your money on snake eyes.
Indeed. Bitcoin is not a get-rich-quick scheme. And we are not encouraging you as an individual to look at it as an investment strategy with short-term risk-reward trading behaviors. We are encouraging all of our listeners to look at it as a savings technology, as a mechanism of holding the stored value of their work, their time, their energy, and their creativity, and giving generously to those who need that. I want to encourage you as well as we close tonight and think about this, that I don't want you to lose sight of the big picture. Proverbs 11:4 says, "Riches do not profit in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death." If you're sitting here tonight and you do not know Jesus Christ, then you need to pick up your Bible and put down that Bitcoin book and read your Bible first and come to know the Lord Jesus Christ, because that is of ultimate eternal value. That is the greatest network of information that can ever impact your life in an eternal way. Once you know Jesus Christ, then obviously we are encouraging you to think about Bitcoin as the best way to take what God has given you to use in this world, in the created world, and that we are to exercise dominion over it and to improve with the technology that we develop and to see the power of what the network effect does. And for Christians, I think it's never been clearer. We have the capacity to take what God has given us, the ability to save, and to use that for his glory all across this world. Don't miss that opportunity today. So as we conclude today, we want to thank you all for your support and encouragement. And we in turn want to encourage you to trust God, love Christ, and love your neighbor, and save in Bitcoin.